Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
As people across the globe wonder what might come of a Trump-Putin summit, Ukrainians have their own reaction.
Sidelined, but also betrayed because USA is our ally.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, the view from Ukraine, plus trying to protect Latin American culture from the AI revolution. Not everyone thinks it'll work.
It is not enough to simply replicate generative AI with local data.
Also, luxury air travel, it's gone to a whole nother level.
Great, we're happy to take your money. Here's a nice glass of champagne.
Why that's cramping things back in coach, plus the heat in Milan, some say it's political.
Some proposals that were considered radical or extreme, now they are very easily adopted.
Those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it today. Artificial intelligence. We know that AI models play favorites. They know more about some regions of the globe than others, for instance. Of course, AI is only as good as the information it's being fed, and that's why tech experts from across Latin America are working on a new model that's been trained using the region's distinct languages and cultures. It's called LATAM-GPT. But where some see a promise of technological sovereignty, others see history repeating. The World's TBS Isaiah starts us off with this report.
Digital expert Alexandra Garcia sat down with an advanced artificial intelligence system about 2 years ago, and she decided to put it to the test with this question.
Le pregunté cómo se come la sopaipilla en Chile.
How do you eat sopaipillas in Chile? Sopaipillas are pumpkin fried pastries traditionally served on rainy days with mustard or sweet syrup. But the AI chatbot failed miserably. It described an entirely different dish.
Y ahí uno decía, claro, aquí ya un error. Y lo mismo con libros. Por ejemplo, yo le preguntaba por autoras, escritoras.
It was a clear mistake, she says. And the same thing happened when she asked about female authors from Latin America. The chatbot provided false information. Today's AI models have improved and might not make those same mistakes. But for questions about local culture or in different languages, Garcia says the models still fall short. She's a project specialist at Chile's National Center for Artificial Intelligence in Santiago. Experts there are building LATAM-GPT, a large language model trained using the region's own languages and culture.
Nuestro objetivo no era competir con las grandes ligas.
Garcia says the goal is not to compete with the biggest commercial AI models, but to create one trained on Latin American culture by Latin American people.
Con datos principalmente de la cultura latinoamericana para la gente de Latinoamérica.
Garcia says the new model uses open source tools and training data collected from more than 30 organizations collaborating from across the region. They include academic papers, news articles, oral histories, and indigenous language resources.
Entonces, lo que nosotros queríamos hacer era que supiéramos realmente de dónde provienen estas fuentes de datos.
Garcia says that transparency makes the model easier to trust and more clear about whose voices it represents. This is an ambitious plan, one that she believes could help Latin America shape its own technological future. But some researchers say there is still a long way to go. Ulises Mejías is a professor of communication studies at the State University of New York.
It is not enough to simply replicate generative AI or large language models with local data if, in the process, you're going to be replicating some of the problems that come with these technologies.
He says large AI models often centralize control in the hands of the companies that build and maintain them, shaping what gets prioritized and what's left out. That can lead to data sets that erase some communities algorithms that amplify inequality, or infrastructure that strains local resources.
And so when we are seeing proposals to develop data centers in some areas in Latin America that are already suffering from a scarcity of water, access to energy, then I think we need to sort of question.
Alexandra Garcia, the expert in Santiago, says LATAM GPT will be hosted by a large data center that's being built in Chile's Atacama Desert. It will be powered mainly by solar energy in one of the sunniest, driest places on Earth. But the Atacama has also been at the center of tensions between indigenous communities and mining companies over water use. In much of Latin America, data centers are hosting foreign-owned AI models processing information for companies based in the US, Europe, or China. Garcia says in this case, the infrastructure and the expertise are local. But Sebastián Lewede, a researcher at King's College of London, says that's only part of the equation.
Latin America basically supplies raw materials, minerals, electricity to run data centers, as well as cheap labor, right? Specifically when it comes to data training. So because of that, it would be extremely relevant for Latin America to figure out how those groups can also participate in the debate.
He's talking about environmental activists, labor unions, and minority groups. Lewede says Latin America needs AI models that help address the region's most urgent problems.
Basically, our challenges are inequality, human rights abuses, lack of democracy in some places, and so on.
Across Latin America, civil society groups are already experimenting with AI. For example, indigenous communities in Mexico are using AI to preserve their languages. Activists in Brazil are developing algorithms to detect illegal deforestation. And farmers in Colombia are creating their own systems to track harvests. Lewede says these grassroots projects are examples of how AI can serve local priorities. And that, he argues, is the real test for LATAM GPT. For The World, I'm Tibisay Isaya, Mexico City.
Across Europe, far-right movements have been on the rise, scoring major wins in local and national elections. That could be a serious setback for the European Union as a whole when it comes to achieving its climate goals. Italy's populist prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, has been critical of what she calls a green agenda in Europe. And climate activists fear her influence may be growing continent-wide. From Milan, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Italian lawmaker Claudio Borghi doesn't deny that climate change is happening.
I live in Como, and in front of my home is a beautiful lake that 80,000 years ago was a glacier. So the climate indeed changes.
Borghi is a member of the Italian far-right League Party. He's talking to me in a chic office space tucked away in a leafy courtyard in Milan. But he says he's not sure what's causing the change.
Whether it's the men that make this change, well, this is another subject.
And if it's not man-made, well, what is it then?
Well, it's if the climate changed when there was the dinosaurs, I mean, throughout the whole history of the Earth, probably the reason is the sun.
The sun, he says. Borghi's party is part of Giorgia Meloni's coalition government. They disagree about lots of issues, he says. But when it comes to climate policy, Meloni is on the right track, he says.
I think that the no-nonsense approach that Meloni has put forward to this subject is well-suited for our need.
We must protect nature with man at its core.
This is Meloni speaking last November at COP29, the UN Climate Change Summit.
An approach that is too ideological and not pragmatic on this matter risks taking us off the road to success.
In May, Meloni said the EU's green policies were in danger of destroying Europe's industrial base. And her influence on other European leaders has climate activists like Paola Del Dosso worried. I'm extremely concerned, she says. There were signs of a real global commitment a few years ago to tackle climate change. But now, with politicians like Meloni and Donald Trump, we see climate goals being compromised or dropped altogether, she says. Del Dosso can't meet me in Milan. She's barred from the city. In March, she stormed a famous restaurant here with members of the climate activist group Ultima Generazione. The restaurant called the police and an official complaint was filed against Del Dosso, banning her from coming to Milan for a year. In the next few months, crackdowns on climate protesters like Del Dosso may become a lot more frequent.
Questo provvedimento avrà il consenso, il voto favorevole.
In Parliament this June, Augusta Montaruli and other members of the Italian government backed a new security law that expands police powers and introduces tougher penalties for protesters. And Italy is not alone in its crackdown. Courts in the UK, France and Germany have all handed down increasingly tougher sentences to climate activists in recent years. In the EU Parliament last month, a group of far-right parties took control of talks on the bloc's 2040 climate goals. The group's chair, French far-right leader Jordan Bardella, said they will resolutely oppose the EU's target of reducing emissions by 90% in that time. But analysts say it's not just the far right who are putting Europe's climate ambitions at risk.
Some proposals that were considered till a few years ago as radical or extreme, now they are very easily adopted by the center right.
Valerio Alfonso Bruno, a fellow at the Far Right Analysis Network, says centrist politicians are caving into the demands of the extreme right. The changing attitude of the US administration to climate policy is also likely to influence EU lawmakers, he says.
If they do that in the US, why we should be following all the, you know, very binding rules in Europe? Let's be more pragmatic. Let's be, you know, like reduce our commitment to our climate goals.
European politicians like Giorgia Meloni say it's impossible to compete with the likes of the US or China if the bloc sticks to its current climate ambitions. Back in Milan, I ask far-right lawmaker Claudio Borghi whether he thinks the EU's Green Deal, essentially a plan to reach net zero emissions by 2050, is still on course.
I think that the Green Deal made in Europe is one of the biggest mistakes of the history. I think that is not dead yet, but will be soon.
Climate activist Paola Del Dosso tells me even members of her own family aren't convinced that climate change is real. And they voted for Giorgia Meloni, she says. Some days, Del Dosso says, it can be hard to stay optimistic.
Ci sono dei giorni in cui mi dico, ma forse è meglio che la smetto e penso alla mia piccola vita.
Sometimes I feel like giving up and just focusing on my own little life, she says. But then I hear scientists say there's still time to turn things around. And I think, let's not waste the opportunities we still have left, she says. For the World, I'm Orla Barry, Milan.
Tomorrow, in our coverage from Milan, when lawmakers aren't doing enough, people take matters into their own hands.
Parents and also the neighbor community decided to make it car-free and to set plants, trees, benches, ping-pong tables.
Get all of Orla's stories on how Milan is coping with the heat online at theworld.org. It's not snakes on a plane, and it is real. Jellyfish in a nuclear power plant. Near Calais in northern France, four reactors at one of the country's biggest nuclear power plants shut down this week when a swarm of jellyfish squished into the cooling system at the Gravelines nuclear power station. The jellyfish live in the North Sea, where their numbers have spiked thanks to rising sea temperatures and overfishing, which cuts back on the predators that might otherwise eat the jellyfish. That water from the North Sea is drawn to the plant through a canal and used to cool the reactors, and in this case, it also drew in the jellyfish. The operators of Gravelines say there were no safety risks to people, the plant, or the environment. Can't say the same for the jellyfish, though. Similar past incidents have turned the creatures into goo. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. One of the joys of summer is, of course, going to the beach. One problem, the public restrooms. It is hard to find a beach toilet that's even close to tolerably clean. For that, we could take a lesson from Japan, where a government project has elevated public toilets to an art form. The story from reporter Patrick Nguyen is a favorite from last summer.
I'm on a mission to find a toilet that talks.
This toilet can be operated by using your voice.
That's Tokyo's own voice-operated commode, featured in this promo video about a wondrous line of public toilets. There are 17 total, designed by world-class architects, each commissioned by officials in Shibuya, one of the busiest sections in Tokyo, known for its nightlife. The most famous toilet not only talks, it listens, flushing when you tell it to, and it even plays pop music. As the toilet promo video says,
"These iconic toilets became the new face of Tokyo."
The Tokyo Toilet Project started in 2020, but debuted new facilities as recently as last year. This spring, local officials started an official van tour of all 17 toilets. Eager to meet that talking toilet, I bought a ticket, only to realize it's one of the last stops on the tour. But that's okay. All the toilets are pretty cool. My tour guide, who asked that I just call him Mr. Kazaki, he tells me foreign tourists can't believe these exquisite bathrooms are free public facilities on the side of the road.
Yes, every foreigner, amazing.
At one of the first stops on the tour, me and Kazaki are crouching together inside a toilet stall, examining an instrument panel on the wall with 11 different buttons. One button simply says rear. If you sit down and press it, the toilet washes you with jets of water.
Oh, this is washer. Washing the
backside.
Backside and dryer.
It washes your backside and dries you off, Kazaki says, with warm air, like a hair dryer. When you're ready to leave the bathroom, just press the open button and the doors slide apart, elevator style.
And now they open, if you finish.
High-tech functionality is only part of the toilet's appeal. Many flock to see the imaginative architecture. One, next to a busy park, has transparent walls, colored lavender or green. You can see right into the stalls. Sounds disconcerting until you realize that by going in and locking the door, whoosh, the walls turn opaque. No one can see inside. Another set of toilets is housed in a white glowing cube. Here's architect Su Fujimoto.
It is quite exciting to create new definition of public toilet, something beyond the normal dirty public toilet.
Fujimoto is a big name in Japanese architecture. He has offices in Tokyo and Paris. The toilet project he designed was inspired by fountains in ancient Rome, historically a place to collect fresh water. It's a touch of serenity in a hectic part of Tokyo.
It is kind of a chaotic situation. So this pure whiteness is showing a strong identity, like cleanness and something really open and welcoming.
Cleanliness is a guiding principle of the Tokyo Toilet Project. Each toilet is scrubbed down thrice daily. As for the voice-operated toilet, its designers were aware that many people hate touching anything in a public bathroom. So they imagined one where you don't have to touch the doorknob, the faucet, or the toilet handle. The whole thing runs on verbal commands. From the outside, it looks like an immaculate snowball, the size of a small house. Supposedly, you just say, "Hi, toilet," and sliding doors open right up.
Hi, toilet.
Hi, toilet.
No? Hi, toilet.
But it's not working. So we press a button that says open and go inside, into a white-walled room with a commode in the corner. It's supposed to play rock, jazz, ambient tracks, and get this, a special frequency that apparently helps you, you know, go. But we're not having any luck making the toilet respond.
Hi, toilet. 音楽お願いします.
No dice. Outside, I meet a Canadian tourist, an architect, on a similar pilgrimage as myself. Her name is Dami Lee. Before I showed up, Lee went inside and tried to lock the door with her voice.
I thought it was understanding what it was saying. I thought it was locked, but it wasn't. Somebody came in. Yeah, that was kind of an awkward situation. I couldn't get it to work.
But I've come too far to give up. I go back in there, determined to start a dialogue. I ask it to play a song. And in the faintest voice, the toilet finally talks back.
Say it again, slowly and clearly.
Say it again, slowly and clearly. Okay. I tell it, please play pop music. And if I strain my ears, I can hear it. A Japanese pop song, faintly emitted from some tiny little speaker. It's not quite what I imagined, but for a toilet, a public toilet, not half bad.
Have a nice day.
Okay. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Tokyo.
The Estonian duo Pulup has a video for a song they put out a few years ago. It begins with the two musicians flying over a Baltic town as though they're professional base jumpers. But then they crash into a tree. So begins their song Keparu. The scene in the music video reflects Pulup's attraction to nature and tradition, paired with perhaps an aversion to modern technology. That seems to be the driving spirit of their contemporary take on Estonian folk music. They use a traditional northern lyre known as the talharpa that can be plucked or played with a bow. The talharpa is only the starting point, though, for musicians Ramo Tater and Marco Wiesen, who complement the sound with percussive lyrics that evoke Bobby McFerrin and beats that are hardly traditional in their part of the world, Estonian folk in dub, for example. Pulup's embrace of folk tradition that sounds a little out of place in the present day, but that contrast works musically in their favor. Tater and Wiesen will be bringing the sound of Pulup to the U.S. next month in October. They'll be performing songs from their latest album with the talharpa up front. With a beat that invites the room to dance, this song, Iksindus, translates from the Estonian as loneliness. New music from Pulup. More global news coming your way. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Israel's airstrikes on Gaza City have intensified over the last few days. The Palestinian Ministry of Health says that in the last 24 hours alone, 89 people in Gaza have been killed in Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, foreign ministers from 25 countries have signed onto a statement calling on the Israeli government to allow more aid shipments into Gaza. The statement says humanitarian suffering in Gaza has reached unimaginable levels. Signatories include Australia, Britain, France, Spain, and Japan. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said on Monday that his government would recognize a Palestinian state at the United Nations General Assembly in September. Speaking to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation today, Albanese accused his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, of being in denial about the war.
The Netanyahu government's strategy is just to keep going, just to keep doing more of the same. What we need to do is to do something different. The international community are saying that. We want peace and security for both Israelis and Palestinians.
In Israel, there's growing opposition to the recent announcement of Israel's plans to escalate its military campaign in Gaza, including calls for a general strike in Israel next Sunday in solidarity with the remaining hostages. As for aid getting into Gaza, the Israeli military said that 97 aid packages were airdropped this afternoon. On the ground in Gaza, though, many people are still hungry and dying. The deprivation is causing another crisis, too. The World's Shirin Jafari brings us a story of one group in the UK that's trying to support animals that play crucial roles in daily life in Gaza, donkeys and horses.
It's hard to speak about the suffering of animals when so many people are dying. Israel has killed more than 60,000 people in Gaza since last October, according to local health officials. Hunger is rampant, and at least 1,000 people have been killed while trying to get aid, according to the UN. But animals like donkeys and horses can make the difference between life and death on the ground. In this video by Reuters, a man rides a donkey, swerving to avoid craters left in the road by bombs. The sides of the narrow path are filled with debris and destroyed buildings. The donkey itself looks emaciated and exhausted.
My name is Dr. Saif, an academic and animal lover and researcher.
Dr. Saif Alden lives in Gaza and leads a team of rescuers and vets. He works for a British NGO called Safe Haven for Donkeys. Alden and four others run the only mobile clinic for animals in Gaza. They go around on bicycles and treat donkeys, horses, and any other animal that needs their help. Alden sent this recording from Gaza.
Since this war began, my life has taken a different direction, which is taking care of donkeys, helping them erase and relieve their pain, because such beautiful creatures have done and are doing something remarkable to help us.
The team is tending to a wounded donkey in this video we shared. Wearing black and neon green vests, the men clean the animal's wounds on its back, then they inspect its hooves. Since the beginning of the war, they have treated about 13,000 animals. Most would have died without treatment, Alden says.
Donkeys are very important in our lives. They transport the injured to hospitals. Now we have no imbalances. I can say largely we have no imbalances, no cars, because there is no fuel. And if there are, very, very, very little.
In the absence of fuel, donkeys and horses have become key mode of transportation, he says. When the Israeli forces order evacuation, people pile their belongings on the backs of these animals and move out. They transport water, tents, and other goods. Alden says sometimes pregnant women get to hospital on donkeys. But this work is becoming harder and harder every day. Food shortages have left the team on the brink of starvation. Meanwhile, the bombs haven't stopped.
We have survived many, many explosions. many airstrikes. And I can see it is a miracle that we are still alive.
Just like for the residents of Gaza, Israel's restriction on imports of goods has made it difficult to get the supplies they need for animals. Andy Foxcroft is the CEO of Safe Haven for Donkeys.
The real challenge for them is getting medicines. They're really, really expensive because you can only really get them on the black market now. Nothing is going in. We've had aid shipments held up at the border for over 12 months now.
Foxcroft says they can't get antibiotics, painkillers, or sterilization equipment.
The animals are getting thinner. When the animals get thinner, the harness wounds start creeping in because, you know, the harnesses are rubbing on protruding bone rather than a well sort of fed donkey.
They become more prone to injuries that will likely go untreated because of the lack of medical supplies. The team has been trying to find replacements and make do with what it has. Foxcroft wonders how long they can continue working in these conditions.
I wonder every day whether we're going to hear from the team again or not. That's how fragile the whole thing is.
Saif Alden prays for the situation to improve, both for the residents of Gaza and its animals. People in Gaza have a deep and strong bond with donkeys, he says. So as long as I am alive, I will not abandon them. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The international community is abuzz over scheduled talks later in the week. Presidents Trump and Putin are meeting in Alaska on Friday to talk about Ukraine without their Ukrainian counterpart. On the ground, Russian forces are pushing deeper into Ukrainian territory. In recent days, they've advanced roughly 6 miles beyond the front line, east of the mining town of Dobropilya. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky does not think it's an isolated event. He's warning that Moscow is preparing to launch a new offensive. And he told Ukrainians in a video message ahead of Friday's summit, Ukrainians will not give their land to the occupier.
Дарувати свою землю окупанту українці не будуть. Україна готова.
Any decisions that are made without Ukraine are solutions against peace, Zelensky went on to say. Maya Mikhailuk is among the many Ukrainians hearing that message. She lives in Kyiv, and we've checked in with her periodically since the war began. It's good to have you back, Maya. How have you been?
Well, it's been difficult 3.5 years, but I guess it's been extra difficult 6 months. There's been a lot of attacks, and of course, the political situation, not just the war situation, the political situation is very concerning as well.
Yeah, let's talk about the political situation, also the reality on the ground with Russian attacks and this news of a coming summit between President Vladimir Putin and President Trump without Ukraine's president at the table. What are your expectations?
Well, our expectations are as low as they can be. First of all, we think that's just a farce for Russia to be meeting with America to decide the fate of Ukraine. We have been fighting against Russia for 3.5 years, holding them back from advancing over Ukraine and possibly also to Europe. And it seems unfair that Ukraine is not in those negotiations as well as Europe. But of course, it's been kind of mind-blowing for us to watch Trump going from one extreme to another, from trying to appease Putin to threatening him in 50-day ultimatum, then 10-day ultimatum, and then eventually ending up with the summit that seems to be a place where he's intending to deliver Ukraine to Putin.
Do Ukrainians feel sidelined in this moment, or is it even more than that?
Absolutely sidelined, but also betrayed because USA is our ally and Trump should be helping us as an ally. But also just as you look at the situation, even if USA was not our ally, this is unjust war. Russia has attacked Ukraine. It has broken all possible international laws, killed a lot of people, devastated the whole areas of Ukraine. And now they're going to be rewarded for the aggression. And let's assume the worst case scenario, somehow we are pressured into giving away the land that Trump is so eagerly proposing to Putin. It's not going to end the war. This is going to be just a pause, maybe for a few months or a few years. and having gained the territory that Russia is demanding, they're going to be in much better position to attack us, attack Kharkiv region, attack Dnipropetrovsk region. So this is not the end. This is actually a ceasefire. And that's what Russia is offering. They're not even offering peace. They're offering ceasefire in exchange for territories. It's ridiculous. And we hope that Ukraine and Europe will be able to just stand in the position that we're standing right now and refuse this. This is not negotiations. Trump is surrendering Ukraine, and he has no right to do that. He's a president of U.S. If he wants, he can give Alaska.
Well, let's hear what President Trump said yesterday. He spoke about a land for peace deal at a White House briefing. Here's what he said.
I was a little bothered by the fact that Zelensky was saying, well, I have to get constitutional approval. I mean, he's got approval to go into war and kill everybody, but he needs approval to do a land swap, because there'll be some land swapping going on. I know that through Russia and through conversations with everybody to the good, for the good of Ukraine. Good stuff, not bad stuff. Also, some bad stuff for both. So there's good and there's bad.
Maya, a lot to respond to there for you, I'm guessing, starting with Trump's characterization of this conflict and Zelensky's role in it, going in and killing people, as Trump said. I do want to talk about land swaps, but first, I'm just curious about what you make of the way Trump was talking about Zelensky.
This continues to be just, I don't know, ridiculous talk that sounds like it's Ukraine who initiated the war. It's Zelensky who started the killing. Of course, he has a constitutional right to mobilize the society to defend our country, and he absolutely has no constitutional right to give away the territories. Again, Trump is turning things upside down once again, and it happened before a few months ago when he was trying to blame Ukraine for the war, say that it's Zelensky who started the war, it's Biden who started the war. But it is very clear Russia started the war, and the war was started in 2014 with annexation of Crimea. It happened during Obama, and then war continued during Trump's time.
I'm speaking with Kyiv resident Maya Mikhailuk about her feelings regarding this Friday summit in Alaska without Volodymyr Zelensky at the table. President Trump also predicted that Moscow and Kyiv will make land swaps, even though polls show that a large majority of Ukrainians reject land for peace deals. But with so many people desperate for the war to end, do you think land swaps will just be a bitter pill Ukrainians will have to swallow?
Well, first of all, land swap of Ukrainian land for Ukrainian land. This is, again, what kind of land swap it is. If it was Russian land for Ukrainian land, that would be a land swap. As is, it's basically a surrender to Russian demands. Surrender of several territories that they want to control. And it is not the bitter pill we can take and just sigh a relief that now we have peace. It is a short pause that will allow Putin to get better position on land to attack us. It is a pause that will allow him, of course, Trump promising to lift sanctions, allow him to restore economy, to use business deals with the West to rebuild his army, and he'll come again. And that's why actually Europe is so unanimously supporting us. 26 leaders of European countries signed a letter, I think today, asking Trump not to do this kind of thing, this deal, if it can be called a deal, I don't even know what to call it, with Putin, because Europe realizes that the danger is very real. If Ukraine is taken by Putin, then it'll be Europe.
This is a tough time for your president. U.S. aid is uncertain. Zelensky's approval rating has slid, and he's facing domestic backlash after signing a controversial law last month. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about Zelensky right now?
Personally, I haven't voted for him in 2019, and I was critical of him prior to the war, partly because he was super naive. He was sounding exactly like Trump sounds right now. He was saying, I'll meet with Putin, I'll look into his eyes, we'll just agree to meet somewhere halfway. So when we were electing him, personally, I didn't believe he was a strong enough leader. But since the war started, well, my family, we're supporting Zelensky and what he's doing, and we've been holding back, criticizing him for some domestic things, like he surrounding himself with his friends, trusted friends in the power. But at least, you know, he was doing the right thing by the country, making alliances, meeting with leaders and things like that. Of course, the anti-corruption scandal was a big one, and Ukrainians are not willing to just refrain from criticizing the government because we know we can't afford to fight Russia, you know, for democracy and then lose democracy in our own country. So personally, I was very encouraged that so many young people came out in the protests. And of course, within just a few days, Zelensky and the parliament backed down and reinstituted a different law, which basically gave the anti-corruption institutions the power. So that's, I think that's very healthy that they are listening to the people. They are afraid that they can be, I mean, they're managers. They're not kings. They're not emperors, right? They're managers that the people of Ukraine hired for the time. So we are intending to keep them accountable.
Maya, when we last spoke, your son-in-law had been called up for service, military service. He has a young daughter, mm-hmm. your grandchild. Mm-hmm. What do you hear from him?
Well, he's serving in the army. He's fulfilling his duty. It's hard. It's life of the military, of course, is very different from civilian life. And his daughter misses him. His wife misses him. But he is where he should be, defending the future of his daughter.
A land swap, you know, might bring him home from service sooner. Is that ever on your mind?
Well, a land swap might bring him home for a few months, but then he'll have to go back and it will be much worse. We really don't believe that the land swap is peace. It's just a pause.
Maya Mikhailuk in Kyiv, thank you very much for sharing a few minutes of your day with us.
Thank you.
Maya is a resident of Kyiv. We speak with her regularly about the war in her country. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The golden age of airline travel for some was decades ago.
Time flies quickly when one is happy and comfortable. Tea time is always a treat on this airline, as the pretty stewardess passes delicious sandwiches and knickknacks.
These days, though, long-haul flights can be crowded, sweaty, and uncomfortable. Economy class seems more cramped than ever, more human cargo class. There's a reason for that. Upper and business class cabins have gotten larger in many airplanes, with splashy perks that might be more familiar in hotel rooms. This summer, we asked travel industry analyst Henry Hartvelt to tell us what it's like in these elite suites. Starting with Qatar Airlines, its business class Q-suite is setting a new standard.
Not only is it lie flat, but the center seats can be arranged. So if you're traveling with a group of friends or family, you can have two, three, four people together, dine together, watch entertainment together, just talk, relax. And of course, when you're ready to, you can sleep. And some of those seats can even be converted into a double bed if you're traveling with a partner or spouse.
So Virgin Atlantic is offering something called a retreat suite. What does that look like?
This is at the front of their business class cabins, and it is a larger seat, larger entertainment screen, and it gives you that much more space and privacy. And the game on long-haul airplanes is real estate. It's finite. The cabin is only so large and can't be made any larger. So if you're willing to pay more for that extra room, that extra space, airlines are going to sell it to you. But they're going to sell it to you at a hefty premium, generally 20% or more above the business class fare.
I mean, you make a great point. Space is finite on a plane. How are folks in economy paying the price for these expansions up in front of the plane?
Literally, the people in economy are paying the price by being given less legroom, less personal space, as airlines focus on their premium products, including premium economy, a cabin in between standard economy and regular economy, and even seats in economy that have extra legroom. If you want more comfort, if you want more service, if you want more attention, if you want more privacy, you need to be prepared to pay more.
You know, it does not seem like there would be room on a commercial flight for showers or something resembling private bedrooms. How common are those?
They're very rare, and those are found generally only on the Airbus A380 Super Jumbo Jet. This is a double-decker airplane that, frankly, looks like a whale when it's parked at the airport. You cannot miss it. And Emirates, the airline from the United Arab Emirates, was the first to install a shower on its A380, but only for its first-class passengers. Mm. And Etihad, another airline from the UAE, built what they call the residence, which is a private apartment.
Wow.
It has a bedroom with a double bed and a sitting room with a couch, and it's intended for one or two people traveling together who really want to have the ultimate in privacy. It's more like a private jet experience. You have a dedicated cabin attendant, you get even special lounge access and more. So airlines are focusing on their premium products because literally that's where the money is. The airline industry for years focused extensively on driving down costs, and cost is still very important. But airlines, especially since COVID, have recognized that by investing in premium products that provide tangible benefits, both rational benefits and emotional benefits, people are willing to pay more for their flights. And the airlines are saying, great, we're happy to take your money. Here's a nice glass of champagne.
Are you saying that if a few select customers are willing to pay exorbitant prices for wild perks, that the rest of us can rely on normally priced tickets?
Correct. It's always been the case that the premium cabin travelers have, in one way or another, essentially subsidized some of the coach passengers. Because what the airlines have said is, that the first class customer or the business class customer who is paying at the time many, many times more for their seats were generating enough profit that airlines could offer discounted coach seats.
Just curious, how much is that private suite you were describing on Etihad?
It depends on the flight and so on, but that can be, I think, like $30,000 or $35,000 or more per person, by the way, to go from Abu Dhabi to London.
I mean, the idea that airlines can privilege the wealthy at the expense of general comfort, like back in economy, is that fair?
It's business. It's commerce. You know, airplanes are expensive and they have to be paid for. And in a capitalistic society, airlines are going to chase profit. And that profit makes it possible for airlines to offer deeply discounted economy fares where they may not earn that much money or, in fact, may even lose money on the seat. And then they try to make it up with the fees that they charge, whether it's to reserve a seat in advance or check your bags or pay for priority boarding or things like that.
I did a quick search online for first-class flights between Los Angeles and Tokyo in early September. Cheapest is $5,600 and going north of $18,000. I mean, that's just a price point that's way out of reach for most flyers. If the wealthy want even more space and luxury, why wouldn't they just charter a private jet at this point?
Well, that's a fair point, because to charter a private plane to go from LA to Tokyo, especially if it's just for one or two people, could cost you $75,000 or more, maybe much more, depending on the type of the airplane and some other factors. First class at $18,000 a seat looks like a bargain. It's all relative.
Just on climate change, because there is also that big climate change hit with private jets. But a single individual taking up more square footage on commercial flights, isn't there a climate change cost with that as well?
There is. And in fact, there's a company called Cirium, an aviation analytics company, that just published a report on aircraft emissions. And the most efficient airlines when it comes to lowest amount of CO2 emissions per passenger are the budget airlines, such as Wizz Air and Ryanair in Europe, or Frontier Airlines here in the US, and their counterparts elsewhere. And the reason is these airlines do not have premium cabins. By packing in those seats and filling them very effectively through the low fares they charge, they have the lowest carbon impact compared to other airlines.
Henry, what perk is on your wish list that no airline has managed to deliver yet?
A good cup of coffee.
The simple stuff in life, right?
I have flown more than 100 airlines, and I understand the galley systems that airlines use on their planes. So I'm very sympathetic to the challenges, but the coffee just doesn't taste great on the plane. I don't know what it is.
Travel industry analyst Henry Hardevelt runs the San Francisco-based Atmosphere Research Group. He's been speaking with us about the trend in the airline industry to expand premium travel. Henry, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
The World is co-produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Curtis L. Scribner, Frank Washington, Leanne Hahn, Lizzie and Dan Routman, and Sarah and Stephen Bass. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.